For another perspective on ovarian cancer, I met with gynecologic oncologist Dr. Bradley Monk, and we began by discussing the long-standing issue of primary surgical management of patients presenting with ovarian cancer.
In an ideal world, I think all patients with a suspected ovarian cancer or with an obvious diagnosis of an ovarian cancer would be initially evaluated and undergo surgical management with a board-certified or at least board-eligible gynecologic oncologist. Unfortunately, that's not the case. A substantial number of ovarian cancer patients or women with pelvic masses suspected ovarian cancer have their surgeries done either by gynecologists or general surgeons. And clearly, the outcomes are better when gynecologic oncologists are involved and may even be better when tertiary medical centers are involved. Having said that, once the surgical treatment has been done, the medical treatment can either be done very competently by either a gynecologic oncologist or a medical oncologist. And my sense is that more than 50% of patients with epithelial ovarian cancer receive their medical care, and I mean chemotherapy, by medical oncologists who I think do a very good job. So if I was to guess, maybe even 75% of epithelial ovarian cancer patients receive chemotherapy through medical oncology.
What are some of the questions that you hear from both medical oncologists and gynecologic oncologists about management of patients in this initial phase of the disease?
So in the initial phase of the disease, there are a number of questions that come up. I think what's important, though, is to establish the standard treatment. The standard treatment is maximal surgical debulking, and we've kind of touched on that. But then intravenous platinum and taxane-based chemotherapy, and I think that international guidelines have established the platinum drug as being carboplatin at an AUC between 5 and 7.5, and the taxane being paclitaxel, generally at a dose of 175 milligrams per square meter given over 3 hours. Now, the questions then emanate and alter that standard, and I think one could outline 7 acceptable modifications of what I just described. And although they're acceptable, they're uncommon. And so maybe the reason that they're uncommon is because they're not as good, but maybe the reason that they're uncommon is because that science is emerging. So let's just outline those 7 things. The first would be intraperitoneal chemotherapy. The second would be administering more than 6 cycles of chemotherapy. The third would be giving weekly chemotherapy. So weekly paclitaxel is probably better than every 3 weeks in breast cancer, and maybe that's also relevant to ovarian. The fourth would be substituting the taxane for docetaxel. The fifth would be adding a targeted agent, and specifically the targeted agent would be bevacizumab. And then the sixth would be doing a reassessment surgery, meaning operating on the patient a second time when she's in remission at the completion of her adjuvant chemotherapy to see if the tumor's in remission. And then the final would be continuing the chemotherapy in the face of remission, what we call maintenance or consolidation therapy. So I think the standard upfront treatment for epithelial ovarian cancer is clear. There are some controversies, and I outlined 7 of them, but those controversies, I think, are really uncommon, and I think most agree that 6 doses of intravenous carboplatin and paclitaxel delivered every 3 weeks is the standard.
I guess as an outsider kind of looking at this field, the one thing I find really kind of interesting is the intraperitoneal story. You see such a spectrum of people's viewpoints from, you know, you've got to present this particularly to younger patients to, we never use it.
And I think that you recall that that was the first controversy. And many of us believe that intraperitoneal chemotherapy at the current doses and schedules that are recommended is quite frankly too toxic. I think we accept that the standard arm was the wrong standard. The standard in that pivotal GOG trial 172 published in January 2006 in the New England Journal by Dr. Armstrong had as the standard arm 24-hour Taxol and cisplatin, and I just told you that that's the wrong standard. It also integrates in higher dose of chemotherapy and also a weekly schedule with the day 8 dose of Taxol being given intraperitoneal. So it's not just a route of administration issue, it's a dose issue, it's a weekly issue, it's a toxicity issue, and that's why many of us think that that's maybe not best for patients, and that's why it's uncommon.
What are some of the clinical trials going on right now that are, you know, focused on patients in this situation?
So again, we're focusing on primary treatment. The two number one scientific priorities in the upfront treatment of epithelial ovarian cancer include one of the things that I just talked about, and that was bevacizumab. So one of those uncommon things that are not always practiced is adding bevacizumab to chemotherapy, and that is a GOG trial, and that's called GOG-218. So it takes the platinum and taxane backbone and adds bevacizumab. It also addresses one of the other issues in that it has a third arm, which looks at maintenance bevacizumab, so keeping it going even when the patient is in remission. And then the second priority is also one of my seven controversies, which is consolidation, and it takes patients who are in remission, randomizes them to no treatment, 12 months of paclitaxel, or 12 months of a novel taxane, which is a polyglutamated taxane called Xiotax, and that is GOG-212. So GOG-218 up front with bevacizumab, the consolidation GOG-212 with polyglutamated taxane, those are the two upfront scientific priorities in North America.
Now, are you putting patients either one or both of those studies?
I do, and you know, I'm part of GOG-218. I'm the quality of life PI in that. We mentioned that the toxicity in intraperitoneal chemotherapy is key, and I think at every step, in ovarian cancer management, quality of life is important. So Bob Berger is the PI of GOG-218, and I'm associated with the quality of life component of that. And yes, we do enroll patients on that one as well as the polyglutamated taxane consolidation trial.
How do patients respond to the idea of participating in these two trials, the randomization involved, and what do you observe once they get on these studies?
So both of these trials are difficult. The first one is placebo-controlled, and so patients have issues related to placebo. The good news in the GOG-218 bevacizumab trial is that two-thirds of the patients get bevacizumab. So that is enticing. It's hard to get reimbursement for bevacizumab. The consolidation polyglutamated taxane trial is that one arm has a no treatment, and then one of the arms is just flat-out paclitaxel. So patients generally in that arm say, look, if I believe in consolidation, then treat me off study. Or if I don't treat me and I don't want to undergo this randomization process and have the control taken away from me. So there's no question that there are issues in both of these trials, but we try to explain the scientific rationale to this. And let me point out importantly that clinical trials still have value even if you're treated on the standard arm. Because the recipe, if you will, the management, the dose reductions, the monitoring, everything is standardized, and there's real value to the patient to be treated on a clinical trial, even if you get the standard arm, because the rigor in the way that clinical trial was designed, basically mandating that the patient gets treated correctly, even if it's with standard treatment, which is okay.
I don't know if you've ever had this happen to you, but if you did, I'm curious how you'd respond if a patient came to you and said, look, cost is not an issue. I've read about bevacizumab. I don't want to go on a study and take a chance that I won't get it. It looks to me like it maybe is going to help and not too much risk. Would you give it to me off study?
It's funny you should say that. So the other day I had a family say that, and I told them that bevacizumab was a very expensive drug. It might even cost upwards, close to $10,000 per cycle. And the son reached into his money clip and looked at his money clip, shook his head back and forth like he was saying no. And he looked up and he says, do you take a check?
Wow.
So the answer is yes. And I think that the exciting thing is, at least in recurrent disease, because we have three phase two trials, which shows that this drug is active alone. Remember, in other solid tumors, breast, colon, and lung, it's approved with chemotherapy, and we're certainly studying it with chemotherapy, but it's also active as a single agent. But these three phase twos in recurrent ovarian cancer as a single agent lead to the scientific body of evidence that convinced insurance companies to pay for it, at least in recurrent disease. So we're getting many, many patients reimbursed with recurrent ovarian cancer and bevacizumab. Not so much up front, and that's where our number one scientific priority, GOG-218, is happening. The good news is that up front, we want 2,000 patients as a final enrollment. We have almost 1,300. So there is broad enthusiasm for enrolling their patients on this frontline carboplatin paclitaxel bevacizumab trial.
It's interesting because I've heard a spectrum of responses to that question. I think there's some people who wouldn't, use Bev in that situation, even if the patient offered to pay for it. Although to me, I think it would be pretty compelling to at least give the patient that opportunity.
Well, and everyone has their own philosophy in how they treat patients. And some physicians are conservative. They want definitive evidence Others realize that these patients are fighting for their lives. So long as we understand the toxicity, that it's okay to push the envelope. And certainly, bevacizumab is a drug that we understand, even in ovarian cancer. And so I think that many people think that it might be reasonable occasionally to treat patients off trial. But please don't misinterpret what I'm saying. My priority is to enroll my patients on GOG-218.
I've got to say, too, because this issue comes up, you know, in lung cancer and colon cancer and even in breast cancer, where I think there's even a stronger sentiment not to use Bev as adjuvant therapy off study. But, you know, in ovarian cancer, it seems like it's a little bit more encouraging in terms of what, you know, sort of the background behind it, the fact that you see single agent responses, as you mentioned, which you really don't see in these other solid tumors. So I guess there's, you know, maybe more reason for optimism in ovarian cancer.
I couldn't agree with you more. And in the first two phase twos that were published last November in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, the editorial by Stan Kay was entitled Bevacizumab's Finest Hour. For the reasons that you said, that the level of activity seems to be at a different magnitude. And if you think about ovarian cancer, ascites, after all, is angiogenesis out of control. What do I mean? That these new blood vessels are leaky. And these leaky blood vessels extravasate fluid. The good news is that that can be taken to an advantage in that it can also cause macromolecular chemotherapies to leak out into the tumor. And we talked about polyglutamated taxane. But liposomal doxorubicin is a classic example. The reason liposomal doxorubicin is so effective in recurrent ovarian cancer is that it stays intravascular where it needs to be, intravascular, like in the heart. But yet in the tumor where it needs to be, it extravasates out of these fenestrated leaky blood vessels. So we understand that. That's VEGF driven. And that's why these anti-VEGF molecules are effective. And that's why macromolecular compounds are effective in ovarian cancer.
Let's talk a little bit about recurrent disease. Can you first kind of outline your clinical approach to these patients?
First of all, surgery is an option if the patient has a long treatment-free interval. And why do I say that? I mean patients that are still chemosensitive. The reason surgery works in ovarian cancer is because this is a chemosensitive disease. And also if you can resect the tumor, certainly carcinomatosis is not a good opportunity for second surgery. But beyond that, most recurrent ovarian cancer patients are managed with chemotherapy. We've created this paradigm, though, that when the tumor comes back quickly, and we've kind of set a dichotomy here at 6 months, but it's certainly a spectrum, that if the tumor comes back in the first 6 months, we call it chemotherapy-resistant disease, and we retreat that patient with a non-platinum taxane drug, and the FDA has approved liposomal doxorubicin and topotecan in that setting. And we already said that bevacizumab is also active.
Do you know roughly what fraction of patients are platinum sensitive versus platinum resistant?
And it's interesting. So you use the word platinum resistant. I use the word chemo resistant. It's not a subtle difference. So I think that there's no question that patients are platinum resistant, but they're also chemotherapy resistant. And really, that's more relevant in the chemotherapy-sensitive cohort because I think in the chemotherapy-sensitive cohort, I don't think you necessarily need to use platinum. So if you call them platinum-sensitive, you imply that they need platinum. But the answer to your question is somewhere around 20% relapse within the first 6 months, and they're called chemotherapy or, if you will, platinum-resistant recurrent ovarian cancer.
And can you talk a little bit about how you sort out options and management, you know, sort of sequences for both of those situations?
So that's the point, is that most patients are going to see both liposomal doxorubicin and topotecan, and which drug to use first. And it's really an individual question between the patient and the doctor. And you consider the existing toxicities, the amount of disease, the social situation for the patient, because liposomal doxorubicin is given every 4 weeks, which is obviously more convenient. And so it's a complex issue. I think the take-home message, though, is that the patient should get both drugs. I would hate for them to get 5-FU or vinorelbine or something and not have had those more important active drugs. I also think that we should emphasize that the dose of liposomal doxorubicin probably should be 40 milligrams per square meter every 4 weeks rather than the FDA-approved dose of 50. And the topotecan should either be given at 1.25 milligrams per square meter for 5 days rather than 1.5, which is FDA-approved in relapsed small cell and ovarian cancer, or weekly. Weekly topotecan is emerging as a very tolerable and probably very close to equally efficacious option.
When you sit down with patients who are about to begin either one of those regimens, what do you discuss with them in terms of what to expect in terms of side effects?
Well, the dose-limiting toxicity of topotecan is obviously marrow suppression. However, when given weekly or at a reduced dose of 1.25 for 5 days, it's pretty tolerable without growth factors. So we explain to them the marrow suppression, although it's almost always asymptomatic, and we try to create some optimism. See, patients want to feel good about their cancer. They don't want to go to their doctor and be depressed, and I think that being optimistic is certainly a part of our job of an oncologist. Liposomal doxorubicin, the dose-limiting toxicity at 40, is still skin toxicity. We talk to them about the hand-foot syndrome, the stomatitis, but again, when used appropriately, those toxicities are rare. We try to have some optimism in a situation that, quite honestly, is pretty dismal.
What are some of the experimental approaches that are being looked at in these patients? Any that are, you know, maybe you think might come into sort of prime time over the next few years?
So I recently presented at the European Society of Medical Oncology a new drug called trabectedin, which some of you may know as Yondelis. This is a drug that was initially derived from the Caribbean sea squirt, a marine invertebrate that secreted a toxin to protect it from its hostile environment. It's a DNA-active drug. It binds to the minor groove of the DNA and forms macromolecular adducts and transcriptional dysregulation. So I took that drug and added it to liposomal doxorubicin and showed that the combination was much more active than the single FDA-approved liposomal doxorubicin. So again, liposomal doxorubicin versus liposomal doxorubicin and trabectedin. Almost 700 patients, and showed that there was an improvement in progression-free survival, an improvement in response rate. And again, to our prior point, that most of the benefit was in patients that had chemotherapy-sensitive disease. Remember, there's very little benefit of anything that we do in the resistant patient. And so this non-platinum doublet, if you will, liposomal doxorubicin and trabectedin, showed very similar efficacy to the recently FDA-approved carboplatin and gemcitabine combination. So again, I'm not sure you have to use a platinum combination in sensitive disease, because now we have recently reported, and probably soon to be FDA-approved, a non-platinum doublet. And I think that that's what you're going to see as time goes on, tremendous controversy, again, relative to the sequencing. So in resistant patients, do you use liposomal doxorubicin first or topotecan first? And now in sensitive patients, the question is going to be, do you use a platinum doublet, either gem platinum or paclitaxel platinum, or a non-platinum doublet, in this case, trabectedin and liposomal doxorubicin? So this whole field is changing, but I think the good news is that there are new compounds every day, bevacizumab and now trabectedin.
What are the side effects of trabectedin, either alone or combined with liposomal doxorubicin?
So it is marrow suppression. The dose-limiting toxicity is marrow suppression. There are some idiosyncratic liver enzyme elevations that happen in the middle of the cycle and get normal before the patient needs to be treated again. But it basically is a marrow suppressive drug. In fact, if you look at the marrow suppression of a carboplatin-gemcitabine combination versus the marrow suppression of a liposomal doxorubicin trabectedin combination, it's about the same. And at the same time, the good news is that both of those combinations have very little alopecia, very little neuropathy, as opposed to the third option in sensitive patients, which is paclitaxel carboplatin. So I think that very soon we're going to have two options in resistant disease, liposomal doxorubicin topotecan, and three options in sensitive disease, carbo paclitaxel, carbo gem, or liposomal doxorubicin and trabectedin. And it's going to be fun to talk about, consider, do research, and present to our patients these options.
What's been seen in terms of single-agent activity with trabectedin?
There are three phase two trials of single-agent trabectedin. All of them show substantial activity in the sensitive patients. So response rates between 30 and 40%. In resistant patients, not so much, between 5 and 10%. If you weren't aware, trabectedin, again known as Yondelis, is approved in Europe through the EMEA in soft tissue sarcomas. It's a very exciting new drug in soft tissue sarcomas after you've failed an ifosfamide or anthracycline-based regimen. And so one of the exciting parts about getting this drug approved in ovarian cancer is that we'll be able to use it off-label in our soft tissue sarcoma patients who heretofore could only get it on a compassionate basis.
Now, you mentioned that the combination of trabectedin and liposomal doxorubicin had an increased progression-free survival, I believe.
Right.
But it was pretty modest. And that's so often the case in trials today in metastatic setting, and you know, a lot of tumors. And it's difficult for docs to look at trials like that and really get a feeling for what kind of benefit they're getting to their patients. Do you see, you know, a subset of patients who seem to have a very prolonged benefit or complete responses, or is this just a question of maybe everybody just getting a little bit of benefit?
So being a drug developer by career, this is part of the controversy. So for example, the carboplatin carbogem package insert difference in progression-free survival is 2.8 months. So as a clinician, you may say, oh, that's not enough. There was no difference in survival. I think that we, though, as clinicians should look at these pivotal trials really as registration trials, proof of principle trials that show that these drugs are active. I don't know if we can overanalyze them and make too many applications to an individual patient. I think that we need to look at the whole body of the compound. We need to look at toxicity and single agent activity and toxicity and all of these issues. So you're right, the 3 month or so improvement in PFS, you know, or the 2 month, whatever it may be, depending on the clinical trial, may not be that important to the clinician, but it really is. And let me give you another concrete example. The most recent approved bevacizumab indication in breast cancer, again, was done so on a PFS endpoint, and the FDA committee, the Oncology Drug Advisory Committee, could not agree whether that was worthy or not. So even experts can't agree on what the good endpoint is. In fact, you recall the vote was 5 against and 4 in favor, and the FDA overturned the ODAC plurality. So it creates a lot of controversy, and I don't think we can overread this. I think that we all agree that GEM is an important drug in ovarian cancer, and trabectedin will be an important drug. And we have to sit with our patient and weigh the risks and benefits. And to your point, in the end, it's all about sequencing, because patients are probably going to see all of these drugs, and we need to use them in the order that makes sense for that particular patient.
What are some of the other new agents out there that are being studied in ovarian cancer that you think, you know, maybe have the potential to come into clinical care in the next few years?
So the next trial, to be positive or negative, I don't know, is a trial of pituperlone. Pituperlone is an apothalone, and you're aware of exabipalone that was just approved in recurrent breast cancer. So pituperlone is a unique mechanism of action. As you know, it's a microtubule active drug. We're interested in using these novel compounds that are sisters, if you will, of paclitaxel. So this is a large 800-patient trial in resistant disease versus liposomal doxorubicin. And that's a hard bar to overcome because, remember, I said resistant patients are resistant, whether it be resistant to platinum or resistant to anything. And so hopefully that will be a positive trial. That will be the next compound or the next results that we have for you, probably ASCO 2010.
What do you know about pertuzumab? I've been really interested in this because, you know, we do so many programs about HER2-positive breast cancer, and I'm curious whether or not anything was ever going to happen outside of breast cancer. What's your take on that agent?
Again, trastuzumab is a HER2 monoclonal antibody. Pertuzumab with a P is a HER3 antibody. And pertuzumab is very interesting because HER3 seems to be an important biomarker and target in epithelial ovarian cancer. So we just reported a randomized phase 2 of GEM. Remember, we said that that's a good drug versus GEM and pertuzumab. And that study met its primary endpoint based on its progression-free survival endpoint. And so we think that we have now shown preliminarily that this is an active compound. And so at the next interim GOG meeting, which is 2 weeks from today in Philadelphia, we have as our really one of our number one priorities to try to sort out what do we do with these preliminary data and how we should integrate that into a more robust phase 3 trial to show that pertuzumab is a good drug. We have lots of study designs that are on the table.
There was a paper at the last ASCO, I mean, I think, and also one in the 2007 meeting looking at that in terms of tissue biomarkers. I think they did RT-PCR looking at HER3, and it seemed like maybe overall the study, the results weren't that positive, but that when you looked at patients who had low, I think it was low HER3, that they were the ones who seemed to be benefiting. Is that the way you put it together? And what do you think that means?
So that was an exploratory endpoint. And so the question that we're struggling with is, does that make scientific sense? And it's provocative. Is that sufficient evidence to only study the drug now going forward based on that biomarker? Or do we need to validate HER3 as a biomarker in a larger prospective study? And personally, I feel that we should study these drugs in the scenarios where we think they're most likely to work. So I would argue that we should use HER3 as a biomarker now to study pertuzumab. And if the study is positive, then expand it to a more broader population. And that's certainly the way trastuzumab was developed. It was developed in overexpressors of HER2. And certainly we've looked at patients that don't overexpress it, and that's created some controversy, I understand. But I'm all for enriching the patient populations that we study to give us our highest likelihood of success so that we utilize our patient resources in the most cost-effective way possible.
What are some of the common questions that you receive from docs in practice about management of recurrent disease?
Well, a number of questions. I think the hardest question is when to start and when to stop treatment. I think we've focused on what drugs, we focused on the sequence, but we don't spend enough time about when to start treatment. Let me give you an example. When the patient feels fine and her CA-125 is beginning to rise, do you jump on that early to try to impact the disease before it becomes bulky and symptomatic? Or do you wait? Because she feels fine now, and clearly chemotherapy is going to impact the quality of her life. That question is being prospectively answered in Europe in cohorts of patients where we tell, or they tell them their CA-125 and act accordingly, and others that they don't. We hope to have the results of that very soon. But I think that really, again, boils down to a person's philosophy. I think I owe you my opinion. My opinion is that patients want to be treated earlier, and I think the earlier that we treat recurrent disease, the better. That is the whole point of tumor surveillance, and we as oncologists, we do tumor surveillance carefully. The other question is when to stop treatment. So in patients that have a PR, okay, do we stop? Or patients that have stable disease? And I think the trend, because the toxicity of these compounds is so well managed and it's non-cumulative, is to treat until unacceptable toxicity or progression. And in ovarian cancer, that can be a long time. And for some of these drugs like liposomal doxorubicin or topotecan or even bevacizumab, where a single agents can be given for extended periods, one has to question, am I really helping my patient by giving her 3 years of bevacizumab? And I would argue yes. With the median progression-free survival between, 18 to 24 months, if you can give her 2 or 3 years of bevacizumab without progression, I think you're helping her. Others would argue, though, well, that's the biology of the disease, not the intervention by the oncologist. So I think that there's two sides of that coin. I don't know if that question will ever be answered. And certainly trastuzumab, we talked about that. That's a classic question. So in the patient with HER2-positive breast cancer who begins to slip or progress on trastuzumab, do you replace the trastuzumab or you just add something to it? Or, do you continue that as the targeted agent? And again, those questions are being answered more carefully in breast cancer, but certainly not yet in ovarian cancer.
What have you observed in terms of the use of bevacizumab in this situation in terms of hypertension, proteinuria, and also bowel perforation?
So the only toxicities that are unique to ovarian cancer that we've seen are bowel perforations. And the risk of bowel perforations is probably twice what it is in the non-ovarian cancer patient. So if the colon cancer patient or the lung cancer patient has a risk of 1% to 2%, then it would obviously be, maybe 3% to 5%. And we think that the further you go in the number of regimens, the higher the risk. We suspect that if you're partially obstructed, that that's a higher risk. But I think we all know what we're talking about. Bevacizumab interferes with wound healing. And if you get a partial perforation or a microperforation, a gastric ulcer, a chronic diverticulitis, on bevacizumab, it's difficult to heal. And that causes a bowel perforation. But hypertension, proteinuria do not seem to be higher, and we certainly know how to deal with those. But because recurrent ovarian cancer is a uniformly lethal disease, I would hate for someone to stop bevacizumab because of asymptomatic proteinuria, only so they can progress and recur and die from their ovarian cancer. So I think that medical oncologists have a history of monitoring proteinuria in the adjuvant setting, okay, where some patients are cured no matter what you do and you can't afford to hurt them, and then translate that into what they're doing in ovarian cancer and get nervous when the patients are becoming proteinuric. So I think, again, it's all about individualization. And I think the good news with bevacizumab in recurrent ovarian cancer is that the risk of arterial thrombosis, because these are women, is less than if you're treating a lung cancer patient, because many of those are men.